Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up, we have American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler. You're on.
Oh, yes. Hi, everyone. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'd like to welcome you to our weekly call-in show on Thursday, American Standoff. And this is a new show. This is our third episode. And we're going to examine the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given myself, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And, a year ago, on January 6, 2021, thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and then stormed the Capitol to contest President Biden's election. These insurrectionists, as I mentioned before, include Proud Boys, folks that we've seen on our own streets marching, and also we've also experienced a Capitol takeover ourselves a week or so beforehand, maybe 2 weeks before, on December 21st, 2020, our own Capitol building was also invaded and assisted by State Representative Mike Nierman. So we're looking today at what happened yesterday at President Biden's two-hour press conference, basically defending his first year in office. Can we start, play some of the audio from that?
Tomorrow will mark 1 year since I took office. It's been a year of challenges, but it's also been a year of enormous progress.
Did you overpromise to the American public what you could achieve in your first year in office? And how do you plan to course correct going forward?
Why are you such an optimist? Look, I didn't overpromise, but I have probably outperformed what anybody thought would happen. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for? Name me one thing they're for. Mitch has been very clear. He'd do anything to prevent Biden from being a success. I get on with Mitch. I actually like Mitch McConnell. We like one another. But he has one straightforward objective. Make sure that there's nothing I do that makes me look good in the mind, in his mind, with the public at large. And that's okay. I'm a big boy. I've been here before. The fundamental question is, what's Mitch for? Did you ever think that one man out of office could intimidate an entire party where they're unwilling to take any vote contrary to what he thinks should be taken for fear of being defeated in a primary? I've had 5 Republican senators talk to me, bump into me, quote unquote, or sit with me, who've told me that they agree with whatever I'm talking about for them to do. But Joe, if I do it, I'm going to defeat it in a primary. We got to break that.
So you just heard from a snippet from the 2-hour press conference given by President Biden yesterday regarding the obstructionism he's been facing in Congress. And I'd like to, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am the host of this call-in show, which is called American Standoff, which is looking exactly at this, the political standoff going on in America today. And this is a call-in show, so I definitely would like to encourage you all to call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. And what did you feel about yesterday's press conference? And what did you feel about the coverage of it? I felt that, you know, listening to the phrasing of some of the questions given by the journalists there, they seem to be intent on not focusing on the issue of obstructionism, on Republican obstructionism, instead reframing it as sort of this internal party Democratic issue, right, within the Democratic Party, and then also not really naming the real reason for the divide, which is white supremacy. They don't name it, and I feel this is a huge problem in the coverage going on, and it's a problem because if we don't name the problem, how can we address it? You know, referring to the voters, Americans, as just Americans, or just you begin to sort of denude and to remove the framework of white supremacy from the issue at hand, and I can understand why these Beltway reporters are maybe afraid to discuss it. From what I saw of many of them are white themselves. They probably fear backlash from white Republicans who are very, very outspoken and have actually stormed the Capitol with guns. and you know, they're part of, I've discussed before how having white privilege sometimes makes it impossible for people who live within the house that white supremacy built to see the problem accurately. And maybe they lack courage. They lack the courage to identify what's going on. And so this show is to place the issue of white supremacy squarely back in the conversation that we're having about the standoff in America today and the great danger it poses to democracy and the ability of people of color, Black, Indigenous people of color, to be able to participate, right? And so I definitely would like you all to call in. Once again, the call-in number is 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. And you just heard a video of Biden discussing Republican obstructionism on important issues like voting rights, like the passage of the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which actually failed last night, and the infrastructure bills like the Build Back Better bill. And I'd like to play now Rachel Maddow's response to his critique of Republicans and his question, what do they stand for?
Domestically, you're absolutely right. I mean, that sort of refrain he had about Republicans. What are Republicans for? What is Mitch McConnell for? What would the Republican Party have in its platform right now? What would they say they would be for on immigration, on drug prices, on inflation, and all of this stuff? I mean, that is that, and sort of his reflections on how obstructionist Republicans are with him, in his words, even more so than they were with President Obama, I thought was interesting to hear from a president in his own words. I think it's also objectively true, and a real challenge to the, I think, the common wisdom, at least the Beltway common wisdom, about how the dynamics are at work right now on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, he came out, one of his earliest lines was, I haven't been able to get my GOP friends, he still sees them as his friends, despite their current political posture, into the game. And then he went on to read a letter from Governor Sununu, where Sununu basically says, nah, I'm not going to run for the Senate. Those guys are for doing nothing. And he says, I didn't anticipate such a stalwart effort to make sure I don't get anything done.
And, you know, famously, during the Obama administration, right, there's this meeting of Republican graybeards where they say, our most important priority is to make Barack Obama a one-term president. We're going to oppose him on everything, on even the things we agree with him on. I mean, that was the lesson of the Obama years in terms of legislation and what the Republican Party was for. President Biden is saying, on the one hand, he's surprised to be getting that same treatment from the Republicans. Now, in addition to that, you also have a significant chunk of the Republican Party voting to not admit that President Biden won the last election, to not certify the electors, right? To stand against voting rights, the authorization of the Voting Rights Act in a way that defies even the recent legacy of Republicans like Strom Thurmond. So I do think that on the sort of core issues about democracy and whether we are going to continue to exist as a democracy, there is a newfound radicalism, sort of an unpatriotic radicalism. But I think the president is objectively right about that.
So that was Rachel Maddow commenting on President Biden's two-hour press conference yesterday and the issue of Republican obstructionism and the danger it poses to voting rights in the country today. And once again, I'd like to encourage you to call in. The studio number is 503-231-8187. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and as I mentioned at the top of the hour, that I am a Native journalist based here in Oregon, and I am also an Indigenous citizen of an Indigenous nation, which the U.S. occupies our homelands, it occupies the homelands of several hundred Indigenous nations across the United States, and we still exist politically, we persist. And I will be using an Indigenous lens to examine these issues over the next, going on the third episode of 12 episodes, looking at this political standoff in America today. And these matters, like I said before in the last two episodes, these matters not only matter for us who live in this country, whether, you know, we're part of the colonial occupation or we are Indigenous people resisting colonial occupation, but this is the most powerful country in the world, built largely on the wealth accumulated through the taking of the resources from Indigenous people and of people, particularly Black Americans whose ancestors were stolen from Africa. Their very lives helped build this country, and they have not been compensated in any way. And the terrorism against Black Americans continues to this day. But the earth, it also endangers the earth and our mother and her children. So I'd like to acknowledge right now that we are on land, what we call Portland, Oregon, but they are the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Calumet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes that once called this place home for several, and still do, for several thousand years. And so I'd like to recognize that. I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, which is based in the Southwest, and my father was from the Yankton Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, in the Dakota, in the Great Plains. And so, you know, we have a particular perspective here in Oregon. You know, we live at the end of the Oregon Trail, as I mentioned before, and where, you know, white pioneers supposedly came to bring progress, and this sort of promise, this sort of new religion of manifest destiny, and a policy of genocide and destruction of the old order that had existed here for some 15 millennia, was supposed to make things better. And has this happened? I'd like to hear your opinion about what it means to live in Oregon. And you know, this is the state that created sort of the very concept of giving away land to settlers, the Donation Land Act, which was the model for the Homestead Act, which, you know, has created this rural, white rural divide in America, you know, empowered very small numbers of white people who own land because of this historic land giveaway to have outsized political power in this country and to continue to push issues that marginalize people of color and structural issues. So today the question is Republican obstructionism and the role it plays in destabilizing democracy and equality for everyone in this country. And polling shows that a significant majority, 55% of Republican voters, say they'd be more likely to vote for a GOP candidate running in the 2022 midterm elections who question the legitimacy of Biden's victory. You know, I think that was something that was not properly addressed in the by the reporters who were asking the questions. At Biden's press conference yesterday, the fact that so many reject his very right to be—they think that he's an illegitimate president, right? And you know, now even the Republicans who stood up to Trump, you know, they are now following the electorate and supporting the big lie that Biden lost the election. And as Rachel Maddow notes, a large number, as is noted in the clip we played, a large number of Americans believe the election was stolen, and 147 Republican lawmakers still objected to the election results after the Capitol attack. So this is after the Capitol was invaded, and some of them were hiding out in fear. You know, they brought a noose in to hang Vice President Pence. You know, they still voted to reject Biden's election, 147 Republicans. And, you know, in his recent January 7th op-ed in the New York Times, Richard L. Hassan, in an op-ed titled, "No One Is Coming to Save Us from the Dagger at the Throat of America," you know, he writes about, you know, he's proposed the 28th Amendment in the Constitution to defend and expand voting rights. He talks about the fact that more than 70% of Republican voters say that they believe Mr. Trump's false claim of a stolen election, and 59% say that they accept that accepting the big lie is an important part of what it means to be a Republican today. Let that sink in. 70% believe that Biden was not actually elected to be president. They believe that Trump is the president, right? And so, you know, within that context, you know, Biden having to spend 2 hours to defend his first year in office without that context being really addressed at all is an incredible oversight and an incredible act of cowardice by the mainstream media, I think. Cowardice to address the issue of white supremacy and to frame the current problem in that way. So I'd really like to hear from some of our callers to find out what they thought of yesterday's press conference. It's all right if you have a different opinion than me. I think we all need to hear from each other what we feel, and I think it's very important to address this issue. And the other thing I'd like to address is the issue of the filibuster and the role of Senator Manchin and Sinema, Democratic senators, one Manchin from West Virginia and Sinema from Arizona, in installing this issue. And so I'd like to play a audio from our senator, Senator Merkley, and his take on the importance of the Voting Rights Act.
And there's no bigger issue than defending the ballot box, taking on dark money and billionaires buying election, and certainly a gerrymandering. So this is a type of paralysis we're facing right now that has been afflicting the Senate on everything. But when it comes to an issue of this magnitude, the fundamental integrity of our elections, the fundamental access of every American to the ballot box, the Senate has to find a way to reform itself.
I want to play something for our viewers of you questioning/challenging Senator Grassley about the filibuster.
Can you help my memory out on this? Because did you not vote to strike down the filibuster on Supreme Court nominations? So you changed your position as well, you would concede, since previously you had opposed getting rid of the filibuster.
I just said it, so you obviously heard me, that we warned in 2013 when I think all Republicans voted against reducing the 60 vote down for district court and circuit court judges so you could pack the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that you'd regret that. And you have regretted it.
It's unclear. Grassley's on two or three sides of the issue at this point. He was for the 2006 voting, federal voting rights renewal. He was for putting aside the filibuster for judges. He's against it now. What were you trying to suss out other than the rank hypocrisy there?
Well, Grassley had just given a speech in which he said changing your position on the filibuster is hypocrisy. And it struck me that he had changed his position, and I thought that was important to acknowledge. Also, he then noted the situation in 2013, saying the Democrats had done something new. I felt it was important to remind people in this debate that what happened in 2013 is McConnell did something new, which is he said no matter who the president nominates for positions on appellate court, specifically the D.C. Circuit Court, that they will never get consideration in the Senate. And that position, which he said doesn't matter what their qualifications are, was a whole new level of obstruction never seen in the history of the United States of America.
Okay. So you were just listening to our senator, Jeff Merkley, discussing the importance of passing the voting rights legislation, which did not pass yesterday, and it was the Freedom to Vote and John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and you know, this is President Biden had warned of future stolen elections on Wednesday, and raised the prospect that an election about an election being illegitimate if these reforms were not passed. And we are looking at a midterm election coming up, and what that could mean to you know, the ability of Democrats to get any of the legislation passed if they lose the midterms. And certainly, you know, the Senate has not been helpful in this, particularly two Democratic senators. During the 2018 midterms, I did write extensively about those the election of Senator Sinema. She is one of two Democratic senators from the state of Arizona, and I wrote about the role played by the Native vote to get her elected in Arizona, and there's some interesting history there that I'm actually been working on developing a television pilot sort of about Arizona politics. It sounds rather obscure, but my grandparents. Some context here. My grandparents were traditional Navajo elders. They, you know, their generation, most of them did not go to boarding school on the Navajo Nation. I think only like 6 or 5% of Navajos of their generation went to school. So they, for the large part, did not speak English. And so it sort of, I think there were about 30,000 of them when I was growing up. And it sounds strange that there are all these American citizens who do not speak English, who speak only Navajo, who you know, who are traditional people, right? And you know, I saw their growing up with them ranching near the South Rim of the Grand Canyon. Being surrounded by elders. You know, they had large families, so they had several siblings. About 15 siblings alive still who were their age and still traditional Navajos. And being surrounded by that as a child, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I really was, I was really blessed because I got to see how they lived their life on their own terms, right? And, you know, my grandfather was a cowboy, and my grandmother wove rugs, and so it's Navajo rug weaving. They were actually not able to vote in Arizona until the late 60s, until the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Arizona was one of those states that were that was protected by the Voting Rights Act, until the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, Shelby County versus Holder decision. The state of Arizona was still many states. Which had issues before with with voter suppression of minorities, had to get all of their sort of changes, their gerrymandering, everything approved by federal oversight. And in fact, the Navajo Nation has sued. Well, they sued the state of Utah, a county in Utah, under the Voting Rights Act, and won. I think I mentioned that last episode. I have written a book about Bear Deer's National Monument and the role that Native leaders played in getting that passed in that area preserved. But the county, San Juan County, where Bear Deer's National Monument is located, was in violation of the Voting Rights Act. They had basically gerrymandered all of the Navajo voters, who were the majority in the county, into a single district, and so they could only vote on a three-member county commission. They could only vote one commissioner on, so they'd always be outvoted by the white minority. And so the Navajo Nation took them to court and won. And so the provisions, if they were then, they were able to get the county ungerrymandered and redistricted. So now, in 2018, that same election, they were able to have two Navajo county commissioners. So Navajos have a more proportionate voice in that county as far as how federal funds are spent, all kinds of things that come down to the county level. So my grandparents and many elders, traditional elders, were not able to vote until the 1960s, until the Voting Rights Act was passed in Arizona. And so the ability of the Native vote to support, and now the Navajo Nation has about 175,000 people living on the Navajo Nation. There are 400,000 enrolled members the vast majority of Navajos do not live on the Navajo Nation, which is about the size of Ireland. It has a population equivalent to some of the smaller European nations like Iceland. And it is a country. Most of the people on the Navajo Nation still speak Navajo. So when you travel through it, you turn on the radio and you'll hear Navajo radio, the Navajo language on the radio stations. So it's still a living nation. But the ability of Navajo voters to have their voice heard at the national level is once again being threatened, and it's threatened by their own success. I did a deep dive into the county numbers in a piece I did in 2018, and looking at the election of Senator Sinema, she was estimated to have needed about 35,000. She's 35,000 votes short of beating the Republican, certainly, the Navajo Nation delivered that. I think I estimated they delivered 80,000 votes for her. So in these sort of red or purple states, it's often the Native vote that is the deciding vote, because the non-Native rural and urban vote is usually about equal, and so it becomes the Native vote that can tip, put the thumb on the scale, choose the actual senator. And the National Congress of American Indians issued a white paper several years ago, actually after the election, 2000 election of Senator former Senator Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. The Native vote managed to get her into the Senate with only 2,000 votes, and there are about five senators who owe their seats to the Native vote in these rural states, these red states. So Native vote is incredibly important, but there have been enormous strides done by the state legislative level to try to suppress the Native vote. And we saw that in North Dakota with the attempt by the state legislature to force voters to have an ID that has their address on it. And many of these reservations, the lack of infrastructure dollars that go to reservations means that there is no effective mailing. The mailing system is incredibly primitive. People don't get mail delivered to their homes. They have to buy boxes, which sometimes are not located in their districts. So it's quite difficult for them even to do the mailing. I did a whole article about Sierra Magazine last year. I think it was in 2020, the beginning of the pandemic, I did an article. And then we have more challenges happening now to the voting, to the ability to turn out the vote for people of color. And this includes, there are a lot of, I mentioned this before, the NPR study that found that 15 Republicans are running to be state secretaries of state. And in order to, and they pledged to basically loyalty to Trump, right? And they will, during the next election, they hope to be able to not certify elections that don't meet their political standard, which is pro-Trump, right? So it's quite scary. I would love to hear from any callers about what they think about the situation. And how what they heard when they listened yesterday, what you all heard when you listened yesterday to Biden's press conference. The number here is 503-231-8187. And this is American Standoff. We're looking at the political divide in this country. And I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. So I would love to hear from all of you. And an interesting story about the Navajo votes. The first time the Navajo vote was turned out was actually by Goldwater himself, Mr. Conservative, and he was running for the first time, and he was of course from a wealthy family in Phoenix and part of the sort of the establishment there, and also very connected to the mob, shockingly, to the mafia. And he was actually a friend of the character who was the inspiration for Mo Green in the Godfather movies. And that's sort of what my TV series thing is looking at, actually. And it's the whole the mafia in Phoenix. And so he managed to turn out the vote for himself for a Republican candidate and began this whole Republican sort of era before that. Arizona was having a Democratic state, and he turned out the Navajo votes because his family were Navajo traders and working on the Navajo Nation. And so you see here where the Navajo votes brought in a senator who transformed American politics towards conservatism, set a conservative message and agenda for the United States. And then now the Navajo vote has brought in Senator Sinema and Senator Kelly, and now we see Sinema obstructing the ability of just a very narrow sort of majority with the Vice President Harris's vote to for the Democrats to be able to pass legislation that would ostensibly save democracy as we know it. The Senate bills would not have fixed some of the more immediate issues facing a Democratic crisis. State laws that suppress the vote and extreme partisan gerrymandering that's going on, and so these state efforts basically create a huge really tilt the playing field in the GOP's direction and create huge burdens on groups attempting to get voters from minority communities to the polls. And actually, I'd like to play an audio from the press conference yesterday from President Biden discussing this particular issue of voting rights and the role that the impact it will have on minority voters.
Allison Harris.
Thank you, Mr. President. Speaking of voting rights legislation, if this isn't passed, do you still believe the upcoming election will be fairly conducted and its results will be legitimate?
Well, it all depends on whether or not we're able to make the case to the American people that some of this is being set up to try to alter the outcome of the election. And it's one thing, look, maybe I'm just being too much of an optimist. Remember how we thought not that many people were going to show up to vote in the middle of a pandemic? We had the highest voter turnout in the history of the United States of America. Well, I think if, in fact, no matter how hard they make it for minorities to vote, I think you're going to see them willing to stand in line and defy the attempt to keep them from being able to vote. I think you're going to see the people we're trying to keep from being able to show up, showing up and making the sacrifice it needs to be made in order to change the law back to what it should be. But it's going to be difficult. I make no bones about that. It's going to be difficult. But we're not there yet. We've not run out of options yet.
So that was President Biden discussing yesterday the issue of voting rights at his press, 2-hour press conference yesterday, and and I actually was I was not happy with his statement. It was factual. He did call out Republican obstructionism, and this was really the only time he tipped his hand regarding the issue of race, the role that white supremacy plays in all of this. And the issue really is where minority voters will have to basically fix the problems that are being orchestrated at every level by white Americans to prevent them from voting by standing in line for hours and hours, which is what happened in the middle of a pandemic. Minority voters, and this is in the midst of course, Republicans closing down voting sites. Also striking voters off the list, right? Trying to prevent anything that would allow voters, particularly voters of color, to be able to exercise their vote, right? And in fact, some states are actually passing laws that will prevent, that outlaw people from bringing food and things to people standing in line, right? So, you know, I don't know if it was hopeful or what, but him saying that no matter how hard they make it for minorities to vote, I think we're going to see them willing to stand in line and defy the attempt to keep them from being able to vote. And I think you're going to see the people who they're trying to keep from being able to show up, showing up and making the sacrifice that needs to be made in order to change the law back to what it should be. So it sounds like it actually comes down to people of color who are being disenfranchised actively at every level to actually change this and not in the face of white senators, particularly even senators that they may have elected, like Sinema, right, who are obstructing the ability to exercise their vote through inaction, and so it's it just seems to be to me incredibly unfair and incredibly is this really the only answer we have? I'd love to hear from some of you. People are pretty quiet today. Please feel free to call in. The number here is, you can call into, this is the call-in show, American Standoff, and you can call in here to the studio at 503-231-8187. I'd love to have you part of this conversation to discuss President Biden's press conference and how you feel about what it means for voting rights in this country, and the kind of obstructionism the Republicans are taking part in. And I think last week I ended the show discussing my grandfather and my in Navajo I call him Shiche, which means in Navajo we have different names for different grandparents. Our maternal grandparents, our mother's parents, are called the grandfather Shiche and our grandmother Shimasune. And for my father's the paternal grandparents are called Shanella. Both are called Shanella. And Shif means my in Navajo. So Shanella, Shiche, Shimasune means my grandmother, my grandfather, my paternal grandparents. Of course, my father's people have different words. In Dakota, I would call my grandmother Kunchi, So it's a multilingual, indigenous sort of experience I've had in growing up. But I discussed what it was like to have a traditional grandparent and and how when even though we were growing up, I was living in Washington State growing up, when he would come from the Navajo Nation, you know, he would bring, I mean, that worldview with him, those traditions, and how he would make us stand, stop and stand by a river that we crossed every day, to be able to give, to talk to that river, to thank it, to address it, to ask for it to protect us, you know, his grandchildren and his daughter and his son-in-law. And, you know, he would offer up patadine and corn pollen to the river. And, you know, this was even as the traffic was passing by on the bridge above us, and pray in Navajo, you know, and talk to the river this way. And you know, the sort of demonstration of respect and expectation that part of the living world, part of living in this world, is to build relationships with the natural environment, you know, is what my grandfather, my Shiche, taught me by example, by just simply doing it, right? And you know, he didn't speak English, so he couldn't discuss this with me in English, obviously, but, you know, he lived it, and I could see that. You know, it's that way of life that he demonstrated that is true to him, right, and true to my mother, and because that's what she was raised with, and that's the basis of which she understands and judges everything else in the world, right? And my grandmother and all his siblings, my great aunts and uncles who I saw growing up, and it's what we learned from watching them, and so I want to bring this conversation back to, you know, my initial sort of analysis of the U.S. being a colony, right? And a lot of the issues that we see happening at the national level, like the standoff in Congress, is really due to the colonial inheritance and DNA of this country.
We have a caller.
And great, we have a caller. Okay,
Mr.
Barnett. Go ahead. Okay. Hello?
Hello, this is Mr. Barnett. Good morning, and thank you for being there. Thank you for doing what you're doing. I have a couple of comments about Joe Biden's speech marathon yesterday, as well as what his first year has been like. Would like to hear me share it?
Yes, I would.
First off, as far as his presentation yesterday, after listening to all, I listened to quite a bit of it, but it was a regular busy day for me, so I couldn't listen to all of it. It was, as I understand, it was 2 hours, but I did catch a good bit of it online, and then later other kind of commentaries from different people later on. But the point is that, as far as I could see, summing the whole thing up, it was a disaster, a total failure. And it reflects the kind of failure he's had all along since day one when he got into office. For instance, how in the world yesterday he could say before the whole world that he was surprised at the pushback against him and his administration, as well as it was against Obama. How could he be surprised? I mean, Something is wrong. Either he's just lying or he's an idiot. One or the other, I don't know. But he was there as a vice president with Obama, so he knows that they said that they were going to do everything they could to stop anything that he had to do, and that there is no reason to think that they would change that tactic. And so his being surprised is just so disingenuous. It's just incredible. I couldn't imagine him even saying that. And then
I have to agree with that. Yeah.
And then even during the speech, with little comments like, "Oh, my friends on the Republican side," how in the world could he be so appeasing? He's been appeasing. Even that speech was all appeasing. He's standing up for whole bunches of issues, like the COVID, like the climate, like the racism that's endemic and that was, you know, has been on display over and over again with all the killings of African Americans, as well as the whole thing about the January 6th. I mean, you know, it's a racist organization. But I understand the comment that you made, and I, when you said at the beginning of the program, this is a racist country, and perhaps, I can't, it's, this stretches the imagination, but perhaps white people like him, like O'Biden, like Biden and all of his people, either they can't see it because they're racist themselves, or they're just covering up. I mean, I, you know, it just boggles the mind. I have no reason for him to make a statement like assuming that black people, and I am one, would vote the way they did that got him into office, you know, during the pandemic. I mean, you know, he hasn't really done anything that would really, you know, make a difference. I applaud and agree with the number of people of color, Native American and African American and others, people of color that he's placed in, you know, significant positions and so forth. And that's crucial and that's important. But, I mean, at the top, in the decisions that he needs to make and can make, but some by executive action, and some, he's got to find some kind of a way to, I mean, he couldn't even get a change in the filibuster rule, which is critical. And it was a, this filibuster rule was created during the time of a really entrenched racism. It was a racist thing, the whole thing. And so he couldn't get
Tom Thurman used it.
And now we've lost the vote. We've lost his protection for the vote, which will definitely affect all people of color, a lot of indigenous people particularly, but African American, Hispanic, and indigenous, and Latin American too. So I don't know. It was a disaster. His administration this first year is a disaster, and that speech. And the final thing is, I'm worried that in order to get America's attention away from him, that he is going to try to push the agenda toward war with Russia, even if it isn't a full-blown knockdown drag-out war. But that's what Democrats do, is get people's attention, focus on, well, I'm protecting America, and so we've got to go to, we've got to fight these people, and that to get people's attention, a focus on his own failures. So that's my comment.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I totally agree about not probably I don't know about the war aspect, but I do agree that you know, his the sort of collegiality in the Senate and in Congress and in D.C. in the Beltway, it's only possible for people who live within the, you know, I say within the house that white supremacy built, white privilege, right? This idea that, oh, this is a nice guy, this is a good guy. And he talked about trying to, I think in the previous thing, trying to, you know, to get Strom Thurmond to change his opinion. And I think even Hillary Clinton was saying that Strom, she gave, did she give his eulogy or something and talked about him being a great guy? And yet this was the guy who voted, who filibustered voting rights. And, you know, he gave the longest filibuster inside history to try to prevent the passage of the voting, the original voting rights bill, 64 years ago or so, and so it's yeah, I think it's I found that very frustrating to listen to and to hear him say that and call them his friends and it was and to be surprised. I thought that I do agree. I think that was disingenuous. Or if it's not disingenuous, yeah, it's because I don't call it. I mean, I think racism is the product of white privilege, and because white privilege means that you know, you don't understand what's going on because you've been living in a construct that is created by white supremacy, and so you cannot see the larger sort of experience or what's actually going on.
We have a caller.
Oh, another caller. Okay, Cornelius. Great. Hello. Oh no, lost the caller.
We lost him.
All right, call back if we lost you, whoever you are. We would love to hear from you. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is our new call-in show, Thursday call-in show, American Standoff, and we're looking at the political standoff in the country today. I'm an Indigenous journalist, and I will be kind of giving an Indigenous perspective on this. We just had a caller who, you know, took issue with the kind of language that Biden tried to use, the appeasement language, and you know, he did mention in the press conference that he was probably approaching the presidency in the wrong way as sort of a senator president, right? As having been a member of the Senate so long, but he was a vice president for 8 years under Obama, and had a first row seat on sort of the obstructionism that Republicans engaged in him. And why is it that he thinks that that would not apply to him? Right, it would apply to Obama, but not apply to him. And you know, it was, you know, either, you know, he is, you know, he's trying to still appease white people who are acting in ways which promote racism, you know, white senators, white leaders, and instead of, you know, really engaging them. And I think this idea that, and also the way, which I critiqued at the beginning of the show, the way in which, you know, Beltway reporters seem incapable of approaching this issue with the context of race, right? They, you know, the questions they ask constantly sort of put the onus on somehow Biden being able to deliver things which are made impossible by Republican obstructionism, which is tied to race. You know, what they're not discussing is that most Republicans are white Americans.
We're calling her back.
Okay, great. We got the caller back. Hello?
Hi there.
Hi.
My name's Cornelius, and I want to... I'm not here to disagree with the last caller, but maybe try and clarify where I see there's probably a bit of a misunderstanding.
Go ahead.
It just seemed to me, I did not get to see any of the speeches that occurred as I was working at the time, but I've watched several I've seen Joe Biden speeches since he became president, and just so you know, I voted for him, but he was not my Democrat of choice prior to the election, and then he was the one that was running, so I voted for him. I never understood when he was vice president why Barack Obama chose him. I mean, there were some political reasons, but I didn't really understand it. Since seeing him as president, I've started to see his language, and he's actually gotten to speak from his mind, and I see why Barack Obama chose him as vice president, and I'm now proud president because he has been bringing the fight on all of these issues that the previous caller seemed so upset about. At least the president's bringing the fight, and the fact that the failings are on the Senate and the House of Representatives and both sides of the aisle, by the way, those failings are to fight that Biden brought up. And the fact that he brought up the fight, I think we should be proud of him for.
Yeah, I also agree with you that it is for some, we do have to put context to, you know, the past, being a president during a pandemic. He did mention that he wished he could go more and talk to people and explain to them what was in certain bills so they could understand it, engage it on that level, and go, you know, across the United States and talk to American voters. And he has been unable to do that because for very good reason. We're having a worldwide pandemic that is unprecedented in modern times, and for which there is no, you know, precedent for. I just said that actually. And also, yeah, I think that, you know, he was criticized by a lot of the reporters for trying to do too much, like, or did you overpromise, is how they put it. And in fact, unless you ask for something really big and have it whittled down, you're not going to come away with anything. Do you know what I mean? And I think that speaks to his experience in the Senate for so many decades. And so, you know, he knows that part of the game. I think, you know, and I think that his 2-hour very cogent responses to these questions, you know, shows that he is still, you know, I mean, he's often been covered and for different, you know, questions have been, I think one of the actual reporters, asked him to his face during the press conference yesterday if there was truth to anything that he wasn't that he was having mental decline, right? Which is a talking point of Trump, right? Of Trump supporters, and which I thought was very I thought that was inappropriate.
Yeah, very rude.
But he was asked, and he just dismissed it. And but I mean, his 2-hour press conference in which he was able to discuss these things in depth certainly proved that that is not the case. Do you know what I mean? And this is a press conference we would never have gotten from Trump, for sure. You know,
right.
And so it's I think in that level it is. You know, I am not. I obviously was. He wasn't my top choice for president either. I think that he's made some pretty bold moves, and he did get a lot of this infrastructure bill passed previously. And even though it was chopped down quite a bit by Manchin, Senator Manchin in West Virginia, he's trying to push things through, and those are significant achievements.
Even his language, like speaking of his Republican friends. The previous caller seemed to be really critical of him using that term, but I'm sure if you have a coworker that, you know, you've worked with time again, you have conversations, you know, things don't turn to fights, you know, you work with them for years, you know, you consider them your friend. And then, like, I had a friend that when I found out he voted for Trump, it completely redefined who I thought of him as a friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but before that even became, before the Trump election, if that was a no issue between us. There were no issues.
Yeah.
We were friends. But, and Joe Biden has worked with these senators, these Republicans, for many, many years, a lot of them. So I would imagine they are truly friends. And Joe Biden's hope is that the legislation he's putting forward just simply makes so much sense. Things like voters' rights, things like the economy improving, and so on and so forth. He believes these are the right things to do, and that people of sound mind, no matter which side of the aisle they're on, should agree with that. And what he's saying is that his friends don't agree with just the basic logic because they are on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how what he's saying. He has a bit of a sense of humor and an honesty that we just aren't used to seeing after the last 4 years of presidency.
Yeah, I think I think that he can address the issue that he's had long term private relationships that we're not party to with some of these senators who have voted in ways and represent ideologies which are trying to disenfranchise people of color in this country. And but I think that I mean, I can understand using that language of they are my friends in a way of trying to change the tone of the conversation that's going on and the kind of, but the fact is the language being used by Republicans they don't feel any need to try to appease Democrats. I mean, and I think this speaks directly to the framing I'm trying to apply to this issue of the fact that the U.S. is a colony, and part of the colonial sort of DNA is white supremacy, and therefore, because this is part of the actual DNA of the country, these folks who hold white supremacist and ideas and policies don't have to come to the table. They don't have to excuse themselves. They don't have to be nice or polite about it. And right. And they can even go and enter the Capitol building. Their voters, their constituency can go and enter the Capitol building of the United States with guns, and they will still support what brought those people there, which is the idea that Biden was not actually elected. You mean the Trump is our actual president, and that's what I find very disturbing, and I think that's why we need analysis that can somehow help us get out of the house that white supremacy built. Get out of it, because it's actually not only destroying democracy and you know, creating a situation of terror for people of color in this country, but it's also, you know, endangering the world when you look at how they vote on climate change, you know, pulling out of the the Paris Accords and when Trump was there, and all of these things, these steps that we could be taking, you know, they're fighting at every level, you know, and so it's quite disturbing, and I think yeah. that is actually the framework that needs to be applied to understand it, and his response speaks to the way in which white people are unable to address this, even the most powerful white people in the country, you know, if they're not on the right, if they're not on the side of white supremacy.
Well, thank you very much for letting me speak.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your voice, and I agree. I think it's important to address the thing, you know, the steps, the, you know, the way he's spoken out, and I'm glad you brought that up. So we're actually at the end of our show right now, and I just like to thank you all my callers, and for listening. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and you've been listening to American Standoff. We are looking at the political standoff in this country today. You can catch us Thursdays at 10 a.m. This is a call-in show, so please do call in. I appreciate you all. Thank you so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m.
KBOO Portland.
It's in the streets, ear to the streets. It's in the streets, ear to the streets.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we